Hello and welcome to another Horrorific Review. I'm joined once again by Steve as we continue our journey along the Hammer Horror filmography path. Released in 1957, this film tells the story of Baron Victor Frankenstein, who, while waiting execution for murder, tells the story of the creature he built and brought to life. The movie was made on a budget of $270,000 and brought in $8 million at the box office. Just a wee bit successful, this one.
Yeah, fantastic.
I think this movie could quite easily have funded like the entire Hammer Horror, like with that profit margin.
I think you put a base on, future ones with Hammer to say Hammer is here. I know they've done several before, but I think this actually put the...
Well, we've covered them before, you know what I mean? They've done loads of movies, but this is their third horror movie.
Yeah.
And
this is a cracker, but...
Let's put them on the map.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. This, and then, of course, they did Dracula, didn't they, as well? And
yeah, well, we'll get to that, but I think we'll have a few to go. Like, even before they got the Dracula, and I think we're going to see it as we go along this journey, like, even before reaching Dracula, they've already established themselves, you know, in as classic horror.
Yeah, yeah. And it, in some parts, scary, because if you think, take yourself back to 1957, this would have been sort of quite new to a sort of horror audience. I know we had the old Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff stuff, but this sort of started it all over again. You know, you had the color aspect and things like that, and but you wouldn't have expected something along this lines of coming, being built, really, and coming alive and strangling and being that scary. But
well, this is a classic. I mean, it's a Hammer horror aesthetics. It's the set pieces. It's the colorization. I mean, it's the particular tone that they have. That is known throughout, you know what I mean? If you think of Hammer Horror, this movie's it.
Yeah.
I mean, everything else we've seen since, this is the building blocks of the Hammer Horror franchise. And this is before we even get anywhere near Dracula.
Yeah.
And it's a classic. Like, you can still watch this today and still be like, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, absolute classic horror.
I must say, I think it sort of brought Peter Cushing to the forefront and Christopher Lee. And it's probably Peter Cushing's, you know, probably one of his best films that started him off as a household name, really, that Peter Cushing, you know. And
when you think about it, Christopher Lee plays a secondary role in this.
Yeah.
Like, he's not...
You don't really speak to his face.
Yeah, he's wearing prosthetics,
probably
latex back then. He's heavy made up. He's a beast. You know, I mean, he's not like powerful. He's a, you know, he's, we'll see it later on, like he Frankenstein abuse. This is pretty much Baron Frankenstein's story.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also told about through the unreliable narrator as well, because he's wanting the story to be told.
Yeah. And he thinks the priest is the only one who believe him.
He's kind of barking up the wrong tree there as well, if you think about it, you know what I mean? Because don't forget, this is during the time, because it was set in Switzerland, you know, 19th century, wasn't it? Science and religion didn't really get on. They weren't exactly best of pals.
No, especially because... The religion wouldn't have believed in that, so it would have been God this and God that. And if he had said, well, I've built this man from and put him together and brought him to life, it would have been against all what was written in the Bible, etc.
Well, if you think of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, that was, when did that come out? Was that the 19th century?
Late 1900s, 19th century,
right? So it was banned by the church because of the line, "For I am God."
Yeah,
where that was the whole point of the story, was Frankenstein's mania, his god complex, and his downfall. But the reactionary, you know, nature of, well, we'll see it today as well, like, institutions are, you know, reactionary people, be it religious or ideologies, whatever else. It's all about, you know, that faux outrage.
Yeah.
But without looking below the layer, where Mary Shelley's story was actually warning against this type of stuff. Yet the reactionary language of the church and their actions against it, like, just showed no understanding whatsoever. Which is why I can't talk the me personally, I cannot talk the ideologues, because there's nothing there of nuance.
But it was a premonition as well, wasn't it? Of you know, no one would have believed in 1957, or even going back to the 1930s when we
right up the 70s.
That
80s, yeah, transplant. You know, I mean, transplant.
Yeah, no one would have thought we can transplant a hand, but they do. No, they put, you know, new hands on, don't they? They even hearts.
Yeah,
they,
and they grow them. They don't even transplant anymore. Like, they've been experimenting now, and I don't know how far they've got, but they're actually growing the organs.
Yeah.
It's well beyond even.
They replace valves, don't they? I know they do plastic now, but back in the 80s, they used to use pig's valves in human hearts for valve transplants. I think Mary Shelley's was a bit of a premonition, a bit like George Orwell's 1984. You know
what we're living through right now.
Yeah.
Like, that was it was meant to be a warning, not a friggin' roadmap.
Yeah, I know.
For absolute lunatics we'll have today. And it's not even taken aside. It's just, if you're just a normal person trying to live your life, and then you've got some absolute mental cases out there trying to, like, just control everything about your life, it's not good.
Yeah. Animal Farm was another one.
Yeah.
We did Animal Farm at school, and we went right into it saying this, you know, this is very political and things like this. It's surprising how much has been written in late 1800s with Mary Shelley, and it's come to light now.
But that's the joy of storytelling, sparking the imagination. Science fiction, horror have been, you know, it's a human condition at the end of the day, is what's explored. And that's what inspires us then to, you know, progress. And because storytelling has effectively died over the last 20 years, we've now regressed.
Yeah.
If you think about it, we are at the moment reboot, remake, rehash. Dun, 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 dun. Shitty sequel, reboot, remake, rehash. That's all we get now.
Yeah.
And look at the result of society because of it. We're okay because we're old farts and we're just going senile. So that's just part of age. But look at the younger ones that know nothing else, and they can barely communicate, they can barely speak, they can barely think. And it's not even being nasty, it's a tragedy. Yeah. And there's a direct link between storytelling and sparking the imagination and making people think they can do more, or giving warnings. And, you know, that feeds into culture, and culture is what makes you want to be better. Look at technology. Look, we've got to a certain point. We're racing up, and now we've just stopped. Yeah, we're at that stage. Yeah, they're trying to make processors a bit better, they're bloated software, but it doesn't do anything more. It just takes up more memory, and they're making more memory to take up more bloated software. The algorithms, you know, and the technology, they're still messing about with VR.
Yeah,
I mean, that was a concept in the 70s, and it was available in the 80s.
Yeah,
and they're still messing about, they can't get it right. You know what I mean? We've gone nowhere.
No, not really.
You buy a new triangle, or sorry, rectangle. Now, if you think of the times of Nokia, even all the mad phones of the day, and all, you know what I mean, the phone for every occasion, and all sorts of crazy things, and that. But now it's, here's the latest rectangle that does exactly the same as what your old rectangle does, but we're giving it a new letter or number.
Look at,
you know what I mean? It's all connected, and it's all connected to good storytelling. Look at how we were progressing as a society. You know, no society's perfect. We're people at the end of the day. We're always going to bash each other over the head with clubs, given a chance.
Remakes, I don't. After I went to watch Psycho, because I was a big fan of Hitchcock's Psycho 1960 version, and my son says, "Oh, they've remade Psycho. Let's go and see it." And Vince Vaughn just wasn't Anthony Perkins, and after that, I really don't bother with remakes unless they remade Star Wars. So. I mean, you look at Poltergeist.
God, Cameron tried to argue with me. That was a good movie.
No, it was awful.
We were not agreeing on that one.
No.
And I'm like, and he was going through every mental gymnastic possible to try and convince me that was a good movie. And I'm like, nah, mate. we're not returning on this one.
They took a classic and murdered it.
That was,
you know,
awful.
You know,
check out the review in the channel, by the way, folks. It's in there. It's in one of the playlists. The reviews.
You know, if you take one scene from it, when the wife goes, she puts the crash helmet on the kid, and Craig T. Nelson comes in, doesn't he? And she goes, watch this,
and then slides Carol Ann across the floor.
The thing that reminds me of Craig T. Nelson's just look of shock on his face is, and it's not rushed, it's just the right speed of a look of shock, horror, and how probably most of us would look, and it just didn't go right. It was so fast, the new Poltergeist, that I turned it off after about 10 minutes. And someone was watching, I think it was my son that was watching it, and I started reading the book.
Well, unfortunately, I had to stick it through to do a review on it. I was like, yeah. I sometimes like, I hate my job. You know what I want to do? Why am I doing this shit?
Yeah.
At least we'll have movies like this. I think it's the whole, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. I think that's the principal underlying message of the story.
I think it's a man's hope of something that they wish could happen. That it's a story, and you think in the mind of someone, you think, what if that could happen? And of course now, like we said, it's beginning to happen. They're starting to transplant hands, and or have done.
That's been going on for years.
Yeah, and I think back, you know, if you look at Boris Karloff's thing, it was you know, them to put together a man from body parts. And I think it's the feeling from people. They're thinking, oh God, this is something new. And of course now it's a thing that happens.
I would say there's a race now between transplant. You know, there's a field of study. If scientists would stop preaching about silly things and actually get back to doing science, it'd be nice. We could move forward. But there's one train of research about, you know, actually growing the limbs and having them, you know, genetically compatible, because that's a big thing. If they're not genetically compatible, the body rejects it, and then you have to take, that was the whole thing of taking a drug therapy that reduced your essentially white blood cell count.
Yeah.
And then you're, you know, I think they were working on trying to get that you actually can grow the limb. But then cybernetics, you know, prosthetics is really almost overtaken all that.
Yeah.
If you look at the prosthetic limbs now and the electronic ones that are using mobile phone technology.
3D printers.
Yeah, 3D printers as well. Yeah, and
they're making parts on a 3D printer.
Mm-hmm.
I had a tooth replaced, quite a major tooth, and he done it in like a thing that made teeth. He done it at the same time. He took the tooth out, went and made a tooth, and then brought it back and fitted it. And it's like mad.
That's I mean, things like that, because like I said, storytelling, we're not getting any more innovation. It's really stifling.
Yeah.
And it's stories like this that ponder the imagination. Well, could I? Well, if I don't want to do that, what could I do?
Yeah.
You know, and that's you have to put the ideas in there. And then you don't know what someone else is going to take with an idea. And
if you think of a story, you know, they took a, especially in the 30s with Boris Kahn, they took a story that could have been controversial for the time. You know, if, you know, people back then didn't know such things and thought, oh my God, they're taking body parts and making a man. These days, there's nothing new. It's like you said, it's they're remaking, you know, what's the latest one I saw? Bonnie and Clyde versus Dracula was made last year. Yeah, you search it up.
Okay.
Bonnie and Clyde versus Dracula. But they're coming up with these crazy things because they haven't got any original stories.
That's because the people that work in the creative industry now are not creative. They've come straight out of university. They have no life experience. No. You need to live life to have stories and to have ideas. You need to actually be there.
Yeah.
You don't come out of a bubble into another bubble and then expect, you know, you have nothing to offer.
But if you think we never had computers and things like that when I was growing up. So we used to read books. I read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Bram Stoker's Dracula. And we used to read books. And I think that's what made our minds creative. These days, they play on, you know, computer games and everything. They haven't got the creativeness of storytelling because they're too interested in coming up with games, you know, Ready, Steady. Was it Ready, Steady? Something or other about, and, you know, computer games, films about computer games and Tron, you know.
Oh, what's that? That second one
was Disney's. The first one was quite original for its time, because what you were looking at, 1979, something like that.
The early 80s, anyway.
Yes, suddenly, you know, 30 years later, let's make another one because we got computers now. And it was,
oh, it was terrible.
It wasn't original anymore because back when Tron 1 was made, it was original and people went, this is an original story here, you know, and it's good for its time. 30 years down the line, it was, so what? And,
yeah. You know,
and I think this is the thing. People no longer read and get the creativity of books that are, you know, from back when things were creative.
Fun enough, I was watching a thing earlier on because there's this whole thing about the generational, you know, the antagonism between the generations, and it's all stems from social media. Those that have grown up in the internet and social media era that know nothing else can't concentrate. They have to watch. Say you want to tell something to a kid. Say we were to do this, right? We would have to have a computer game playing in the background.
Yeah.
With enough light and stimulation, with us talking over the top of it, for the kid to actually take notice. See this now, just us two talking. Young people they can't deal with that. The fact that this is more than 30 seconds long, they don't have the ability. And it's not even slagging them off. They legitimately don't have the ability to take that amount of information in.
No.
They don't have the attention span. It's gone.
No.
We were in a lot of trouble. Well, we
were actually talking today. I said, there was one of my friends said they missed the olden days. And I said, yeah, the times when your mobile phone was a little red box at the end of the street. and you know, used to in the school holidays, used to help the milkman.
Remember Tempe's used to be that size?
Yeah, I know.
Freaking humongous.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because Cole has still got the old Tempe's over there, a bag of them. So, because I sorted out all his change and everything that he had all around the house. He's still got some old 10p's. But, yeah, they were super size, weren't they? And 5p's, they were bigger.
Yeah, they were pretty decent too. When was that? Was it the 90s? Everything changed? All the coins got smaller and the ridges around there?
I've no idea.
I think it was the 90s.
Yeah. Probably a save on cost, wasn't it?
Well, anyway, this is a tangent and a half.
sorry to plug the Irish, but wasn't it something in the news back along about someone was copying pound coins in Ireland and it was costing them £1.05 per coin?
It would not surprise me. Proper Egypt's out there. Worst counterfeit. That's an old story, that, actually. That's the old lead and the gold. You know, the whole alchemy thing, it is possible to do, but it costs more to produce the gold than what it's actually worth. So it's a, you know, I mean, you can change lead into gold, but it's the value of the gold that you get is actually less than the cost of the process, so it's not worth doing.
So going back to Frankenstein, yep. Do you think that this film cemented Terence Fisher as one of their main directors?
I would say so, because this is the entire aesthetic.
Yeah.
Like, you think what we've watched, like, I know it's only been two movies, but don't forget, it's not just, we've been really covering the horror movies. Hammer, as a film company, has been going for about 20 years at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, he went on to do loads for them.
Yeah, because this is the aesthetic. This is Hammer horror. This is the look. This is when you think of a Hammer movie. Yeah. This is what you, the castles, the backdrops, the costumes, you know, it's the whole thing.
Yeah.
One thing that did with it, this is where they actually made as well the story of Frankenstein interesting, because we get the same as a young boy, essentially a teenager.
Yeah.
And the fact he's established, you know, as the Baron early on in life, and we get to see more into his character, which usually, like the Universal Monster, just focused on the mad science part. But yeah, we got a bit of an insight into the man behind it, which I thought was intriguing.
Looking at it, he done so much for them.
Well, that's good in a way, because then there's been a consistency.
The sort of Spielberg of today, of the 90s and 2000s, where everybody wanted this one director. And I think back I think the horror people thought, we want Terence Fisher. You know, he's a bloody good director. Because, and I think this probably cemented him, this one, as someone who was highly sought after, for especially for horror. Well,
movies. Your film makes that profit margin.
Yeah.
Absolutely ridiculous. You know, it's just
back then $8 million or pounds.
Was, yeah, but on a $270,000 budget,
which was a quite a big budget as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, but the returns, you know, proved it was worth it.
Yeah,
but it's not just a spectacle as well. There's storytelling here. There's characterization.
Yeah,
it doesn't just rely on spooky castles and, you know, monsters. There's actually a whole tale to be told here.
Yeah, because it brings out Frankenstein's madness.
Mm-hmm.
If you think the Baron, when he starts off as a young boy, I must say, I don't know if you noticed who that boy was, but it was a very young Melvin Hayes, who went on to be quite a comedy actor. He was in... what's the one with Windsor Davis? Some Mothers Do Have Them, was it?
I think so.
The one where they were...
It was. I only remember Windsor Davis from It Ain't Half Hot. Davis
in Lofty.
Lovely boys. It's Friday, yeah. Lovely boys.
And Yeah, well, he was actually in that one, Melvin Hayes. Let's check on him. But he was very much a comedy actor in that, and he was very young because he played the original, the young boy Baron. There he is, Melvin Hayes.
And he did it very well because we got an insight. You know, here's someone from a young age had title thrust upon them, power, and basically, you know, could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah.
And instead, like, he could have been a dilettante. He could have just partied his life away.
Yeah.
Instead, he didn't. He dedicated, you know, he had this obsession.
It ain't our fault, Mum.
Yeah, that's the...
Yeah.
That's Wonder Davies, you know, that's a classic.
That was for 7 years he played that. The thing I noticed, which was quite funny, but was when it went from Melvin Hayes to Peter Cushing, he sort of aged quite quickly, the character, didn't it?
Peter Cushing's never looked young, that's the problem.
No.
Peter Cushing has always looked that age. It's like Patrick Stewart. Patrick Stewart's never looked young. Just one of them people, you know, so you can't really do much with him.
No.
He's always looked like that.
Well, it was quite funny because the young Melvin Hayes who played the Baron was quite young compared to Paul. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it went to Peter Cushing, and Peter Cushing looked older than Paul.
Yep, they're probably the same age, if not but younger. Like, I was a young Peter Cushing, but he's always looked like that.
Yeah.
And also, it's good to, you know, hey, today it's all about being hot, you know, and everyone's all roided up and ribbed and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's all they're looking for with Hollywood, but you had characters.
Yeah.
And I miss that.
Yeah.
I miss that it was about, you know, it's not about a supermodel catwalk across the screen, which it is today. In fact, it's not even, because most Hollywood people are bland. Like, there's nothing attractive about them.
No.
There might be one or two, but most of them are just so generic that you can't tell the difference between them. They're so interreplaceable.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just interesting that he hired his own tutor. The business.
Yeah. He says, "I am the Baron. My dad died 10 years ago."
Mm-hmm.
looking at Terence Fisher, though, before...
Hi, Steve Martin. He's Norwin, yeah.
Before this one, a lot of the stuff he did was not horror. It was crime, stroke, it's crime stroke TV, and then suddenly he gets pulled into this Curse of Frankenstein, the Mickey Mouse Club, Dracula. he done Curse of Frankenstein, and then he gets called in to do the Mickey Mouse Club on TV.
That's fair enough. No, I mean, it's good to be versatile.
And then he went up to his next horror film was Dracula, which we knew anyway. And then he went back to the Frankensteins, Hound of the Baskervilles, Man Who Could Cheat Death, The Mummy. So he was brought in to do an awful lot of Brides of Dracula, Dr. Jekyll, Curse of the Werewolf, Phantom of the Opera, Sherlock Holmes and the Deadly Necklace. So the Gorgon, the Earth Dark Scream, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Island of Terror. So he was brought in after the success of this film, Curse of Frankenstein, to do an awful lot of horror. And like I said, this film probably cemented him as the director that, you know, would be highly sought after of today. Like, you know, you got Spielberg, haven't you?
And to be honest, absolutely deserved it, because this is a brilliant film and it's still watchable.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's proper, you're you don't just put it on in the background. You know what I mean? If you're watching this, you're watching it. You know, you're enjoying the story.
Mm. Yeah, I watched it this morning again. I got out of bed and bump, stuck it on. So
it was a strange one with the whole Elizabeth plot line.
Yeah, because he was having an affair with a nanny, wasn't he?
Which is another strange thing. I know what they were setting that up for, but it was almost just to show him as the bad guy. It's like, he's killing people and nicking bodies from graves. You don't need anything else to tell us he's a bad guy, we know.
Yeah, bad guy, nutter, you know.
We kind of get that.
Professor sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole kissing cousin thing, you know, I'm going to marry my cousin. I suppose that was all right back then.
And then to get rid of her, so Elizabeth would find out, he locks her in with a monster. And I thought, that's showing his true side there. Showing what he can do, but...
The guy's absolutely obsessed and everyone's just a commodity to be used and disposed of at will, but that's...
Yeah.
The good thing about this is they spend time on Frankenstein's character that you have to, so you understand that there's no reason with this man.
No.
And there's no real bond of friendship. You know, you don't be friends with this man because he is psychopathic.
Yeah.
And, you know, complete narcissist. So you're never going to have a true friendship with someone like him or a relationship because he's obsessed and that's all he is about. He wants to be God.
From the start, he knew what he wanted, even from a young that Melvin Hayes character.
Yeah.
He'd asked for the tutor. He said something like, you get these tutors who read from a book for 30 years and still get no further. And then he employs this Paul. And even Paul he uses, doesn't he?
Paul was only evil as long as he was going along with his obsession.
Mm.
But like I said, Elizabeth's character, that was a strange one. Because, the family was indebted to him and part of the arrangement was that they married, fair enough. But why was she getting so upset that he's in the lab? Like, she met him, as a child and then didn't see him for 20 years?
Yeah.
It was arranged marriage. There's no real affection there, and yet she's getting like she should almost be glad that he's not interested in her, if you know what I mean. If you're in that sort of situation,
it's all the both arguments, huh?
Yeah. She's got a secure future, gets to toddle about her life, he toddles about his, and it worked, unless an urn needed to be produced. You know, that was really the only time they'd have to worry about anything,
yeah.
Yet she's badgered him about never leaving the lab and stuff. I find that part of the storyline a bit strange.
Yeah.
I know it's more of a storytelling device to tell the audience that he's always obsessed with his work. I get that aspect of it, but we've sort of already seen that anyway.
Yeah. Yeah,
That's the only part of this I don't really get is the Elizabeth character.
Yeah.
There's a side story,
because every story's got to have its, rather than go straight down the line, you've got to go out on a tangent a little bit.
Like this podcast. Okay. People, if you're coming here just for a movie review, jog on, because we'll get back to that eventually. It was just a bit, I think that was overplayed slightly.
Yeah.
That's my only complaint, was Elizabeth's character was slightly overplayed.
Yeah. Yeah, she was... mistake-wise, I didn't find an awful lot. When initially Paul and that were bringing the dog back to life, The light must have been shining on Paul, because you had Paul's character, Paul's shadow on the wall, but you had a second shadow as well belonging to someone. I guess it wasn't Baron Frankenstein. Of course, you had the lovely red paint blood, didn't you? You know.
Come on, that stays with us still about the 70s at least. Until the 80s. Blood didn't become a thing, you know, as in it's the 80s horror, you know, the all the special effects people had their own recipes. You know, and that didn't really come until the VHS era. You know, I mean, that's always this sort of, because don't forget, they're still, even though it's a color film, they're still going through the transition. Because what they would have got away with for a black and white one, they're still using a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And hadn't really perfected the technique, you know, and thinking of color gradients and stuff, you know, it was just something.
There was a thing about Hitchcock, wasn't it? He, even black and white, he wasn't happy with what they were using for blood in Psycho, and he went through several different like kinds of liquids to use for the blood in the black and white film. Yeah, others would have just used black paint or something like that. But,
yeah. That's the bright red paint, you know, just
yeah,
which has been a thing. At least I go by the my stance is digital blood should be made illegal.
Yeah,
that is an abomination. At least I can forgive a bucket of red paint over digital blood any day.
Yeah.
Digital blood. If you use digital blood in your movie, you should go to jail. You should actually do some jail time because you're committing a crime, in my opinion.
Yeah. It's just pretty naff, isn't it? You just don't get the right context of it running as blood would. You know, someone's got a head injury and they do it digital, it just
looks awful.
If you use you know, like their fake blood in that thing, it actually runs similar to how it would if it was your actual blood.
And like I said, when we get into the sort of 80s, that's when people are like, okay, so it needs to dry at this sort of, you know, it needs to go on, but then it needs to dry enough so it looks like it's real, and people really get into their recipes. And I miss all that. And this is the start of it, because it wasn't horrendous.
No.
You know, it wasn't, there's still, like, there's people can't make movies, I guess, today.
Oh. Not at all.
That look as good?
No. This is
twice the budget. There's people cannot make movies that look this good today.
You can watch a lot of the, well, Hammer in particular, you can watch over and over again and 6 months down the line think, oh, I'll watch that one again and not get bored of it. Whereas these days, I buy a Blu-ray and it goes in my box after. I never think, I'll watch that again. Very, very few. I do like the Clint Eastwood movies. I'll probably watch them, you know. But whereas if I'd love to get the complete Hammer House content.
You can't, that is... They haven't actually put that entire collection together.
No.
That's one I've been looking for too. And even I looked in, there was a Hammer Horror like triple box set, and there's even in sex, they were charging like £25 for it. And I'm like, no, yeah. That's a bit much.
Do you think they'd have to, what's it they call it?
You can pick up the Universal Monsters collection, like 30 movies for.
They have to remaster it, don't they? Because the print's so. The original print is so worn.
Yeah, but that would bloody sell. You're telling me that if they re-released the Hammer Horror Movie Collection today as a 4K or even a Blu-ray, they wouldn't sell.
Oh,
if they did box sets,
I'd definitely buy it.
Would be all if they did like a limited. Say they did like a 1,000 run limited series, that'd be sold out in a day.
Yeah.
Scalpers would be all over that too. You know what I mean? That'd be scalped.
I've got the Hitchcock box set. They took all his best films put them in a box set, and it's on DVD. I know, not Blu-ray, but I've kept it because I do like Hitchcock.
No, my next thing's a Universal Monsters collection. I know you can get all 30 movies in the box set.
Yeah,
that's my next thing I'm saving up for.
So if you're listening out there, we want a Hammer House complete box, complete set of Hammer horrors, please.
Absolutely, that would be your shelf just like for them. You set the
how many fans would buy it?
That would be sold out. Yeah. It would be sold out.
Yeah,
but the studios are silly.
Mm.
Honestly, today is just they have no idea. The disconnect between the people that run entertainment and the people that watch and buy entertainment couldn't be further apart.
It's the same with the Oscars, isn't it? You know the only horror film that's won an Oscar for best actor, best
lead? We're not looking at the Oscars. I'm not getting in any more trouble.
Oh, sorry. Dr. Jekyll and
Mr. That was you last time as well. Yeah. Mentioned the Oscars, and I get them coming after me.
All right, the Johns. All right, the Johns. The only horror film that's won a John for best lead actor was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde back in 1920 something. And that's the only one to date.
God, that was funny. Like they
got something about horror films.
They're snobs.
It's
the mainstream.
Do you count Silence of the Lambs? We've had this discussion before. Do you count Silence of the Lambs as a horror
film? No, it's a thriller, but with enough it's horror elements.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely in the thriller category. I think they just shied away from the gore enough.
I mean, most films these days are horror films because they're shite.
Yeah, it's just a horror watching them. No.
I one thing I did notice, which amuses me in the old type of films, is the woodwork of things like banister rails. You know, when he chucked the intelligent
professor. So, let's think about this logically. He wants the professor's brain.
Yeah.
So how does he get the professor's brain? By chucking him off a banister, getting him to land on his head.
Yeah, and he did, didn't he? Boom. Yeah.
And then he blames Paul for damaging it. And you're like, hang on a minute.
You threw it at the basket. But, if you notice quite any film, like that around the 50s, the banister rail never survives, does it? you think, God, if I'd employed the chippy on that, I'd bloody complain and get him done on Trey's description.
The only one that was good banister rail was in The Omen.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a good banister rail. Now that really held.
Hanging off the thing. That made me laugh, the banister rail.
Yeah, but I'm gonna get the professor's brain, but I'm gonna bash his brain in to get it. It's like,
yeah.
You ever heard of poison, mate? You know what I mean? Or sleep?
Yeah. Just whack him. Stick a knife in his stomach. He's not gonna hurt his brain by doing that. But
I suppose he wanted to look like an accident, but I don't know. Paul's character is an interesting one.
Yeah, he's very much a. Yeah, I'll teach you to start with, and then I'm all for it, and then it gets to the point where it's getting quite dodgy, and he thinks, actually, I could get in trouble for this. I think he's thinking, and he pulls back, and then he comes in again, and then he pulls back, and of course, then when Elizabeth invites him to the wedding, doesn't she? And when she goes in and announces it, I don't know if you notice this, she goes and says, Victor, Paul's here. And he goes, Paul? Paul? Oh, Paul! And it's like, is he losing his mind? Like, he doesn't know who Paul is?
He's just completely wrapped up in his...
Yeah.
But The fact that Paul continued to live at the house, he'd already said, I'm not taking part in this anymore. So he effectively had no purpose.
No, and he was living there. He was just living there
rent-free. Like, once he stopped being the lab assistant, he had no purpose whatsoever. I just find that a bit strange. This is the bits where the sort of plot needed tightened up a bit.
The other mistake I did notice a couple of times was on the creature. The scars kept disappearing or moving. There was the scars on the wrist. 1 minute there'd be a scar where they transplanted the hands. Next moment it'd gone, and it would come back. And the other thing, he had like marks on his face, and it would go there, and then suddenly it was there, and then suddenly it was there, and then it was back to there. So.
I suppose they didn't have Polaroids back then, and taking photographs was a big endeavor.
Yeah.
But so.
And if didn't, I mean, if you're like me, I notice things like that. But.
Yeah, but I don't think they would have, you know, like today they would have taken a photograph.
Yeah.
And then they'd just use that as reference to do it again. But I think back then, because I'm thinking about this, because it happens a lot with makeup. And it was just, I think, photography was so expensive.
Yeah.
It was actually an endeavor to get a, you know, a portrait done.
You know,
it was the same as a, you know, you may as well have paid an artist to paint the cost of photography. So to do that for the special effects, I think wouldn't have been justified as a budget.
You know, when the creature, Christopher Lee, when he escaped and he comes across the boy and the blind man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he must have had some intelligence to put a coat on. he went out with that big, thick black coat on, didn't he?
Yeah.
And A, where did he get it? And B, if he was sort of brain dead, would he have had the intelligence to go, of course, it's bloody cold out there. I'm going to put this coat on.
Would he have felt it?
I know, yeah.
Nervin. I thought they were going to replicate the scene, actually, from the Universal one.
Oh, the bar spot.
Basically, you know, the scene with the wee girl by the lake, but have the wee lad do it instead, but obviously they didn't. I was, you know what I mean, I lost count number of times I watched this, but then wee things that come in my head and wonder, was that what they were trying to do, was replicate that scene?
Yeah.
And then you realize, no, they're not. And they're like, what are you thinking, Colin, wise up.
A thing I asked as well, if they executed the Baron, how did they make a sequel? You didn't actually see them execute the Baron, you just saw the
guillotine. That's one of the most iconic scenes in the film, is that guillotine.
Yeah.
That's one I remember from a kid. Honestly, just the sound of that scene with the guillotine, just something about it.
Yeah, but they made a sequel and he was still alive. So,
Well, I think we'll get to that when we
had to use our own imagination, really. And of course, when Elizabeth goes into the lab, and do you think the creature is chained up and everything? And when Victor shows Paul, stand up, and he stands up, sit down, sits down. And of course, and then suddenly Elizabeth comes in, and he just goes like this with the chain and pulls all the bolts out. And you think, same bloke done that bloody bolt as done the banister rail.
Yes. Bloody, maybe don't use balsa wood, just a suggestion. I love, but even the whole laboratory, like that is the classic mad scientist laboratory.
Yeah.
Like I remember being asked in school, like, what do you want to be? Is like a scientist? And, oh, what type? Like mad scientist. You know, I just, like from primary school, I just had this vision of being like Frankenstein with a lightning and all coming from the top and chains and pulleys and just doing crazy stuff. But I'm terrible at maths. So, yeah, that kind of... I discovered that after my A levels. I was like, yeah, I'm not good at this. Calculating stuff.
The one thing I thought was quite impressive for its time, you think this is 1957, was when they set the creature on fire near the end of the film.
Yeah.
I thought back then they couldn't have had things like...
They wouldn't have the Nomex suit or anything.
Suits and stuff like this. And I thought, this is pretty impressive here. They've set him on fire. And I thought, that is brilliant. That's
what I'm saying. There's people can't make movies, I guess, today.
Oh, God, no.
Like, this is brilliant. It's, Steve does the bad jokes in this bit. That's not your segment. You do the crazy theories. Steve does the bad jokes. Stay in your lane.
Yeah, you're for the chop, Chris.
Oh, dear. And it begins. No, that special effect, that was still impressive in the 80s.
Yeah.
90s, you know, it's still an impressive effect. Mm. And the fact that they did it in 1957 is like...
Yeah, I thought... Hey, that's you know, they couldn't have had, because if you think today it would all be CGI, but even if they did do
I watched, because obviously it's a long weekend, I watched The Northman on Saturday.
Oh, no, don't.
I liked it for the most part, but there's a bit when they're in the hall, right? And they've got that fire in the middle,
That's
digital. It's a fucking digital fireplace. I'm like, my God, what are you doing?
But if you think today, if they were going to use a real fire scene, they'd have a fire brigade on standby. They'd have a risk assessor. They'd go for the full
work. The unions wouldn't allow it, you know.
Oh, no, they wouldn't. They'd say do it on CGI. but, you know, back then... And it was quite a long scene, really, for, it wasn't the case of set him on fire, pan the camera elsewhere, and then pan back and he was off. He was walking around on fire.
That would be getting toasty under there.
Yeah.
See, that's a problem. Back then, because there wasn't home video, there wasn't a reason to do the special effects features.
Yeah.
So we'll never really know, apart from maybe the odd interview, we'll never really get the full insight on how this stuff was made.
No.
That's why I think why there's still a magic about it, because once the idea of it was more DVD market, you know, you would get the special features.
Yeah.
And
but if you think back then, it would have been a case of how do we do this? Whereas today, it's we can just use CGI. Yeah. We don't.
There's no magic.
There's no question in heads together have gone, how the hell are we going to do this? You know, we want to set this guy on fire. How are we going to do it? And you would have had a bit like Ray Harryhausen, you know, the special effects guy who does all the stop motion.
Mm-hmm.
In the monster films, you know, and dinosaur films and stuff like that. And he was one of those that went, how are we going to do it? This is how I'm going to do it. Play with it. And it must have been the same back then. We want to set this guy on fire. Bloody hell. How are we going to do that? Let's try
and actually set them on fire and kill them.
Yeah. Whereas now they just... Say, stick it on computer. I mean, you see some of the films these days, isn't it, where they blow up a building and you can tell it's CGI.
I don't watch them. That's the thing. Most mainstream movies, I don't bother with.
No.
I have no interest whatsoever.
It's the
average shit. I haven't watched an action movie in ages because I just no interest, you know. And that was always big dumb fun, but just the, you know, like action movies, you name it, sci-fi movies.
Yeah.
I didn't even bother seeing Dune Part 2 because I just could be annoyed. I'm just like, yeah, I'm not excited. Fantasy movies? Like what fantasy movies are out that are any good?
No, we in the modern horror is not fantastic.
Oh, so God, you see some of what we did yesterday. My God, it was awful. And I've done a couple of the weekends and just absolute crap. Just nothing there.
What was that one I told you we watched the other day? The up to date one.
I can't remember.
It's just out. Anyway, it was crap. God. Imaginary.
Oh, yes, that's right. Imaginary.
Oh.
Yeah, because there's another one that you were.
Yeah. Imaginary.
It was the other one, 14 cameras you were talking about.
That was good. That was good. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I didn't even. I saw that. What was it? The poster for Imaginary? I'm like, nah. I'd see the trailer for it, and I'm like, I just no interest.
It's just not scary. It's, and the actors just seem to be going through the motions. And if the things that happened to me, I'd be booing my pants, and there'd be a look of horror on my face.
And actors are crap, honestly. It's hard to get invested in anything. Mm. That's where, you know, I mean, this is proper character acting.
Oh, yeah.
It's not even, it's not Peter Cushing storming on the stage as Peter Cushing. He always invests in every character. Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
Invests in every character he portrays.
Peter Cushing becomes Victor Frankenstein. He doesn't become Peter Cushing playing Victor Frankenstein. It's like he goes into a different world of playing the character.
We've seen both those. We've seen those two act together in so many scenes, playing different characters and engaging with each other in different ways.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. They just become the characters.
Mm.
Where, like today, it's in fact there isn't even a movie star anymore. You know what I mean? It's even worse because even in the '80s and nineties, you had the action. You know what I mean? The movie star, and they just staggered on the screen, but you don't even have that now. They're just wooden planks and they're interchangeable.
Yeah.
And you can't tell one from the other.
Yeah. And I think it's just
I did a news article on the latest Scream movie coming out. It was Courtney Cox is joining, right?
Scream 7.
And the other one, Neve Campbell, has already signed up for it. But I looked at the picture and I couldn't tell which one was which. Seriously, I couldn't tell the difference. You'd have to put the picture up with their face and their name, and I'd go, "Oh, right," and then that's the other one. But I have no interest in those actors. They're just so bland, so generic, so interchangeable that you could tell me one was the other, and I'd believe you because I just no reference or emotional investment into which is which. They're just terrible. That's what makes this a classic. Could you?
When you get an actor who becomes the character, it stops them being typecast of like you would not say Peter Cushing was Victor Frankenstein only, because you know he goes on to and he plays Van Helsing.
Yeah, I'm sure we've covered him in the Amicus films. Look how many characters he plays there.
He becomes Van Helsing, and he becomes. Whereas actors today, if you think, what's the actor who played Frodo Baggins?
Elijah Wood.
Yeah,
sure, he's terrible.
To me, Elijah Wood would always be Frodo Baggins. Nothing else. I can't think of anything else.
No, well, that's him and
Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah,
he's always Harry Potter because he's just gone in and played that part, and he doesn't invest into it to think, I am Harry Potter. Like Peter Cushing goes in and goes, I am Victor Frankenstein. I'm not Peter Cushing. I'm Victor Frankenstein. I'm Van Helsing. Where Daniel Radcliffe you know, for instance, is I'm being paid to play this character to turn up, and you know, the director's going to tell me how to play this character, and if I do it wrong, he'll whisper in my ear, "No, I want it done like this. I want it done like this." Whereas I can imagine Terence Fisher working with Peter Cushing, going, "You play it how you want to play it, you know, because you're
there's a level of truster,
fantastic actor, and you become Victor Frankenstein."
It was Christopher Lee said in an interview, and I'll remember this, like, at some time in your career, you're going to do a bad movie. That's inevitable. The trick is not to be bad in them.
Yeah.
And that's the mantra, you know, I mean, of that ilk and that time, that's the mantra they live by. It's at some stage, you're going to do a terrible movie, but you, as long as you do the best you can, and you play as if it's going to be the best thing ever, and you put that amount of effort, then you can leave with integrity. But that doesn't
Some composers, if you think Hans Zimmer, when he was, he said, you know, he plays all in his concerts, he plays certain scores from his films, and he actually says that, you know, the film was rubbish, and because the film was rubbish, the music went with the film, and you know, and I like the music, I believe in the music, even though others might think it's rubbish. And I think you know, with films, you could say, you know, it's up to the audience to think this film's rubbish. But it's, like you said, as long as the character comes, you know, the person playing the role comes across this. We've seen films that we've been reviewing.
Oh, yeah, we've done as well. Going, the actor tried their best.
This actor's tried his best.
And that's what, you know, I mean, you can actually forgive a lot of stuff if the characters are and there's an attempt. You get a feeling that there's an attempt to make something good. You tend to be a bit more forgiving of things. When you see that there's no attempt and you're just being thumbed off, then you start to dig into everything. Oh, that doesn't look right. That, you know, I mean, when you get that rubbed up the wrong way with a film, then you just start looking at everything going, well, why is this so bad?
Yeah. There were a couple of times you could see Christopher Lee's skin appear in his neckline under, you know.
Yeah, I'd seen that.
Mask. But I mean, it's only if you're looking for that sort of thing like me.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Because this is a good film, you're not.
Yeah.
Generally, you know, if you're just watching it as a, not to review it or critique it.
Yeah.
If you're just watching it, then you're not looking for those other things. You're just going along with it. You know, I mean, you're invested in the story and you're going along with it.
Yeah.
It's, if this was a bad movie and if it was bad acting, then you'd be really, you'd be hyper focused on all those things because it would just be something else to sort of validate your feelings about it.
Yeah. Did you notice as well? There was a scene where Elizabeth was going up towards the lab. And she was wearing a pair of high-heeled shoes. Now, considering the film was supposed to be in late 1800s, wasn't it? And she was wearing high-heeled shoes. I thought, did they have high-heeled shoes?
Never picked up on that.
Did they have high-heeled shoes back in the late 1800s? I don't know. I'm just looking at my notes here.
Never thought about it. Suppose if they're walking on a pair of trainers or something, I'd be like, I would notice, but I never thought about the high heels.
Yeah.
When was the high heel invented?
I don't know. I don't wear them. Well, I do on Sundays, but...
When was the high heel invented? 10th century.
Oh, right.
So they've been around for a while.
Quite possibly, then. I might be wrong.
Yeah. Persian.
Yeah.
Persians invented it. Yeah. No, they've been around.
Yeah.
They're originally worn by men.
Chris wears them.
Oh, of course. Yeah, special pair for when he comes on for the Tremors reviews.
Mm.
The whole thing with the shotgun as well. I love that. When they killed the monster the first time.
He shot him in the eye, didn't he?
Yeah, with a shotgun. It's like, yeah. His head would have been...
His head apart, yeah. Just looking, the... got a worth a mention. The stuntman who did the fire at the end was called Jock Easton.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 out of 10 to you, Jock, if you're still alive. Because, yeah.
Because that was pioneering. Like, I don't think anything of that era has ever been done like that.
Not back then. And
no, not that level. So that's, you know.
Because it was pretty up around the head as well, wasn't it? It was like,
oh, yeah. That's
there, and it went up. And then, yeah.
And
Jock Easton.
If there's their own whims, the fire extinguisher invented it, because I don't think they would have had. I think it would have been buckets of water.
Oh, yeah. Jock Easton, slung
the range. When was the fire extinguisher invented? Oh, 1723. Flip's sake. Oh, but the traditional one, there's a timeline. Hang on. 1924. Yeah, so the traditional fire extinguisher wasn't invented until 1997. You know the one we're used to, the red one?
Yeah.
Right about 1924, it was like a pump. It's like a gold, brass sort of pump operated one. So it wouldn't have been like, you know, like you see a Formula One.
Yeah.
If a driver catches fire, they're straight away with the carbon dioxide. There'd just been a water fire extinguisher with, if that was a flammable liquid. Actually, when was the CO2 fire extinguisher invented? 1920. Oh, cool. Actually, hold on. 1924.
Hmm.
Oh, flip's sake, that stuff's been around for a while.
Yeah.
There you go. But I don't think it would have had, I don't think they would have used them for the film. It wouldn't have been in the budget. So it would have been buckets of water or something.
Yeah. He was 45 when he did this stunt. He'd been in a few things before, but he died 23 years later, so 55, 65. So he died age 68, Jock Easton. But yeah, he did quite a few stunts. Guns and Avron,
mm-hmm.
Alexander the Great, William Tell, Rachel Hornblower, Bonnie Prince Charlie, Christopher. Oh, he was actually in an actor, Hanged Man. He was the Hanged Man. You know, he was that. And he was obviously the burning creature. So his two stunts were hanging there and thumping down onto the car, which I imagine was quite a bad fall, really. Mm-hmm. The burning creature. So, he's...
They're the two staples of action movies today.
Yeah.
You think about it, they're the two staples. He's a pioneer in the two staples of the action genre and horror, you know.
Yeah.
Fair play to him. There's a scene in this here. The only real comedic scene was Justine, the maid, when actually Frankenstein's trying to get rid of her by putting her in the lab. Yeah. She just goes looking around the place and then stops to, like, could you cut the guinea pigs? Which I just thought, that was so random.
Yeah. I think, but back then, I think for a maid to think that she was going to marry a baron,
yeah, that was never happening.
He was all he wanted was to get his leg over, really, wasn't it? But
yeah,
Because he was quite a, even from day one when his mother died, wasn't it? He was quite a nasty type of person when he was saying, yes, goodbye, get out, you know.
Yeah,
yes, you'll get your allowance, piss off.
Yeah, that was a good insight into his character, but needed that. Yeah.
But that's how he was treating, you know, her back then when she was a young girl. And, you know, they say leopards never change their spots. And because he was, I mean, he was even nasty to Paul when he first came in, wasn't he, saying, mm-hmm. Well, you haven't got the job yet. It showed his character from day one.
Control, power. And control. That's what he was lusting off. Was the ultimate power is to create life, to own life.
Yeah.
It wasn't actually to do anything good. Like, girls, Paul, you know, when they're going through the experiments, think about what we can do with this. We can lower the heart rate. We can, you know, people can survive surgery, et cetera, et cetera. And Frankenstein's just like, no, I just want to own life.
Yeah.
You know, he's just doing it for power, not for any other reason.
Yeah. Yeah, because he said, oh, we can go to this health organization and show them what we've got. No, don't want to do that. With when they brought the dog back to life, and he said, we can do some good with this. And yeah, Frankenstein went, nah, let's carry on doing.
And you think it'd be room, but then again, that's sort of the character. But it's, and once again, even like, it's not really dissimilar from the book. You know, I mean, the obsession of Frankenstein, but he's not a hero.
No.
So for people to react the way they did to his character, as if it's being lauded as the alternative, no, it's, once again, it's the warning of the horror story. The horror story is a warning, as in, don't do this. Don't let your ego take over. Don't become so obsessed that you forget you lose your humanity, because it's never going to lead to a good place. You know what I mean? This is a classic warning of a horror story, which is completely lost today.
I remember talking about the Boris Karloff thing, and someone actually said to me, you've actually got to feel sorry for the creature, because he didn't ask to be made. And he's been made like he is by these mad professors, you know. And it's the same with this Christopher Lee's character. He didn't ask to be the way he was. So you got to think, you know, how much like real life is it today? People aren't, they're born and they don't ask to go through life like, how their life pans out for some reasons as others controlling them. And this is what Victor Frankenstein did. He was controlling over this creature that he made into what he was.
But in the end, here's the sort of warning of it is, don't do that, because it comes back on you.
Yeah.
Where today we don't get that. Today we just get a bunch of whiny, spoiled brats, basically. Oh, well, mummy and daddy have financed this, so I'm just going to be like, me, I'm going to do artsy-fartsy, preach and don't have anything to say. I broke
my mobile phone, never mind. Mummy and daddy, buy me a new one.
Yeah, oh, my life's over, you know.
Yeah.
No. And I don't get it. Like, after... Right, he's a big vat of acid. Because they never really explained how they discovered Justine was dispatched and how they found her, or how that's what ended up being his downfall, was the fact that he killed the maid.
Yeah.
But he's a big vat of acid. Why didn't he just dissolve the body? Where was the proof?
Yeah, because the monster falls in it at the end.
Yeah. So there's no proof that the monster existed?
No, no. So, and then, of course, and then in the jail, you know, he says, you've got to tell them, Paul, you've got to tell them. What can I tell them? Got no proof, really.
Well, that was Paul's...
revenge.
Revenge, but not right there. he the minute he saw Elizabeth, he was thinking to himself, he wants that. He wants a bit of that.
Mm.
He was instantly besotted with Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, he got the girl and he's quite happy. So he's just as much, you know, he's trying to be the play the moral high ground, but we see Paul's character as well. That's why I say he's an interesting character, because he's not a black and white one either.
No.
He's protesting. You know that the he doth protest too much. He's protesting, but he's always there. He didn't leave until it got too much.
He's like the Dr. Watson to Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, sort of nipping at the heels and falling, you know, wanting his belly rubbed.
Yeah.
And he never left, and he helped, and he still, oh, just you have to convince me. His ego played into it as well.
Mm.
And then at the end of the day, he was only there, yeah, to be a knight in shining armor to protect Elizabeth. But no, his plan was he wanted Elizabeth for himself.
Yeah.
And that became really apparent.
Yeah.
And then the final scene, well, he was quite happy for the Baron to get his head chopped off, because then obviously they inherited everything.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Elizabeth will become the, you know, the widow, and then after the a lot of period of time, Paul just mosey on in. Like, so he's not the shining example of a, you know, a stalwart character that he's trying to portray himself out to be. Like, there's a lot of nuance in this film.
Yeah.
Or a 1950s film. Like, there's a lot of character nuance and looking behind the scenes at people's motivations, and it's pretty interesting.
But the characterization was brought out on each one because we noticed it. And then, like we said, going back to the day, they just go through the motions of, you know, you don't get any backstory to a character.
Yeah, it is immortality, you know, the create art of any form. And for it still to be about after you've gone, that's, you essentially do become immortal, you know.
And it's just also a shame that we're going to lose quite a lot of well-known actors within the next few years. Because if you think Clint Eastwood's in his 90s now, Gene Hackman.
Michael Caine.
We're going to...
Jack Nicholson's up there.
Yeah, going to use a whole lot of them just like that, and we're going to be left with these plunkers that you know, these newbies. I always put it towards, if you think a certain wrestling organization, that's all I should say, when you had characters in wrestling bits, I better not say in it who, but you had actual characters, you know, the wrestlers played characters, and now they've replaced them with these younger element, and there's no characters, and there's no backstory, like you know, someone who would bury people.
Is there a thing now that it's the UFC fighters that go into the wrestling now?
Yeah.
So it's just like, and then they get actors and stuff to join in, and it's just, I don't know. I despise wrestling. I've always despised it.
Yeah.
To me, it's the dumbest form of entertainment ever.
The thing I'm trying to put across is you're getting all these younger ones.
Yeah, they're just...
They've got no background. They've just come in and, you know, they've said, you know, okay.
They've roided up, they've oiled themselves, and they're just going to flip and dance.
So it is, you know, I like you because you're good looking. Oh, I like you because, you know, I saw you on the street.
But when everyone's good looking, nobody's good looking.
I know.
Do you know what I mean? When everyone's all looks the same and they all go to the same gym, they all take the same steroids.
Yeah.
It just, there's nothing there. That's why what's her face at the moment, Sydney Sweeney's a big noise, because she actually looks a bit different from every other actress. Every other actress is interchangeable, like you can't tell the difference. There's like Saturday I was out of time, so I was actually watching movies just for fun.
Yeah.
And it was a weird sensation. What, I'm not taking notes. But I tried to watch Evil Dead Rise again. Now, when I went to the cinema, I did enjoy the movie for the most part.
Yeah.
I tried to watch it the second time. And honestly, I just noped out because the actors, the characters are just so bland.
Yeah, I didn't like that film.
I think it was just the shiny lights. Honestly, there's something about going to the cinema. The shiny lights kind of add the experience and it makes it more appealing. But yeah, I just tried to watch it. And I didn't even get to the bit where they found the book. Like, it was just when she arrived at the apartment, I'm looking at these going, I don't like any of these characters.
No.
And there's nothing. The two sets, they look the same. They sound the same. There's nothing about them. And that's just movies today.
I think when you're used to the original movie and you've got the excitement of the Sam Raimi, you know, it was just funny horror, wasn't it? It's, yeah. You know, zombies coming up through the floor when they've been chained down and then you get this Evil Dead rise and you think it's just not Evil Dead.
No, on reflection, it was just, yeah.
Rubbish.
I couldn't even sit through it a second time. Sorry, that's always the acid test. Can you watch a movie a second time?
Yeah.
And if you can't, then you know it's not a good one. Or if you find yourself switching off like this, I have watched loads of times.
Oh, three. Like, as a kid. You know, in the past few weeks. Like I said, I more or less always watch a movie three times to come on here.
But, yeah, and this is even my second time reviewing it. Because like I said, Cameron and I did it a couple of years ago. And it's still fresh. You know, it wasn't like good through the same. I still find something to talk about with this movie. There you go. There's a reason why they're classics.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I can't wait for
The Abominable Snowman, I think it is.
It's The Abominable Snowman.
Oh, there's a great character scene in that.
Is it?
Yeah, because it's Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing in it.
Yeah.
I think Peter Cushing's the one that plays the sort of a bit of woo, a bit of wah, you know, the sort of Del Boy type character. And Christopher Lee's playing like the professor, like the straight laced, you know, no nonsense. Like they're completely different characters and they bounce off each other. This is the one with no, that's the other. Maybe I can tell them up. No, I'm mixing up with Horror Express. Sorry. I'm thinking of the scene out of Horror Express that has Tally Savalas in it.
Oh, yeah.
That's absolutely insane. No, this one I think is just Peter Cushing. I think it's just Peter Cushing in this, The Abominable Snowman.
Did you hear about Bruce Willis, Sylvester Stallone, and Arnold Schwarzenegger got invited to a party? And it was a themed party on composers. So Bruce Willis says, oh, I'm going as Tchaikovsky. Sylvester Stallone says, oh, I'm going as Wagner. And they turned to Schwarzenegger and says, who are you going as? And he went, I'll be back.
Wah, wah, wah. Oh, dear. Right. On that note.
I'll have to get that thing made up when I keep forgetting. But when you get to my age, you forget, see? What was it I was saying?
Not quite there yet.
it's like when I went to Ibiza, I wanted to go to that big nightclub. Have you heard of that nightclub called Amnesia? Yeah, I wanted to go there, but I forgot.
Oh, dear. I don't know. This is almost as much horror as the movies watching. Right. Tune in for more cheesy jokes and anecdotes, and maybe we might talk about a movie sometime. We'll squeeze a movie review in there as well. But thanks again for everyone that tuned in. Keep up to date with the channel. Do the typey clicky things. And until next time, keep it creepy. Keep it horrific.